Tell me a little bit about the scope of what you're doing as part of your business.
So my primary area of research and writing is on end-of-life medical treatment issues, and so that's pretty much the focus of the three main events that I'll be doing at the law school, at the hospital, and at the medical school while I'm visiting at SIU. So last night at the law school, the topic was brain death, which as of about a year ago has sort of been the subject of a renewed focus and attention. This afternoon at the hospital, we're going to be talking about medical futility disputes, which is similar, but these are living patients, but they're catastrophically chronically ill. And the question is it still beneficial to continue to provide intensive care for these patients, or should we just stop and focus on comfort measures only? And then tomorrow we're going to be talking about overtreatment at the end of life.
Let's pick up on that last issue that you mentioned. And there's so many decisions, probably ethical, legal, moral, that I'm sure that both families, physicians as well face, given the state of technology that we have today. But yet at some point, the life of the individual may very likely end. At where have we advanced, or at what point now are we in that discussion in terms of when do you say when, especially knowing that some patients may have living wills or may have specific instructions about how they want to be taken care of or treated if they're in this situation. I know from personal experience, family members may not always agree with what that person wants to do and will fight to do something different to help prolong life. Where is kind of the discussion now in, from a legal and ethical perspective?
So, and there's actually a couple different mm-hmm. discussions. So first, well, I should mention today is April 16th, and it's what's known as National Healthcare Decisions Day. It's a sort of a big nationwide event. There's probably over 1,000 sites trying to encourage and increase awareness of advanced care planning. So you mentioned living wills and advanced directives. So people have the right, the legal right, to refuse life-sustaining interventions that might keep them alive, whether it's dialysis, a mechanical ventilator, and so forth, if they wouldn't want to be sustained in a state that they find not worthwhile. Most people, however, don't complete advanced directives, thus at National Healthcare Decisions Day. So one consequence of that is that the default is everything. If you don't opt out, you'll get every aggressive, high piece of technology to keep you biologically alive, no matter what the state of your mind and so forth. So the one problem we have in the United States is most people, if we ask them, they wouldn't want that. But since they don't adequately record those preferences, they're going to get it, and they do get it. So we do have a lot of over-treatment. It's actually unwanted treatment, but they didn't tell us they didn't want it, so we're going to presume that they did want it. Issue one. And then issue two is there's actually people who find their lives intolerable because of some chronic critical illness that they have, but there's nothing to turn off, right? They're not dependent. They're not in an ICU, so they're not dependent upon a mechanical ventilator or dialysis or artificial nutrition and hydration. Nothing to turn off. So the only way to hasten their death is to ingest a lethal dose of barbiturates. And so we have maybe 30 states now in the country all actively considering bills to legalize physician aid in dying, or what used to be known as physician assisted suicide. So that's another debate we have going on, is the people who want to take not just passive means to turn something off, but active means to basically take some sort of poison to hasten their death. So these are the debates that are going on. I guess there's a third, right? Those are both talking about patients. Do they have the right? Do they have the liberty to hasten their death? Then there's another debate, which is there's people who want to prolong their death. Sometimes they're called vitalists, and they believe that all biological life, no matter what its state, is worthwhile. And it's not up to us, it's up to God to decide when to say stop. But many clinicians in many hospitals across the country think that we've already crossed the point where we've given you everything that medicine has to offer. Medicine really has nothing left to offer you. Nevertheless, you're asking us to continue to engage in medical interventions. And so we have, this is what I'm talking about today, an increasing number of debates called medical futility conflicts, where the family wants more medicine than clinicians are really comfortable providing.
A couple of situations I want to circle back around to, but in that one in particular that you talked about, do physicians have a responsibility to say no more? Or is that a decision that is really not in their hands and they have to go and do whatever they can, even though maybe they think they have done everything that they can for this individual, and nature is just going to have to take its course, regardless of what the family desires?
Right. So this is one of those times, we call it the laboratory of the states, because most of healthcare is regulated by state law, not by federal law. And the states across the country have taken very different approaches to answering the question that you just asked. And I like to use a traffic light metaphor: red, green, yellow. Some states have red lights, meaning if the family doesn't consent to the proposed treatment plan is to move to comfort measures only, no curative measures. But if the family doesn't consent to that, you got to do what the family wants you to do, even if you, the doctor, think that's medically and ethically inappropriate. So I call those red light states, meaning the doctor cannot proceed to do what she thinks is best without the surrogate's consent, the family's consent. Some states like Texas have green lights, meaning if you're the physician and you think what the family is asking you to do is medically and ethically inappropriate, you don't have to do it. You do what you think is best. You're the doctor, after all. And so the law allows the clinician to do whatever they want to do. Most states are actually in the middle. It's not exactly clear to what degree the physician has to accede or follow requests for what they deem might be an intervention outside the medical standard of care, because there's a lot of fuzziness and grayness there. And therefore, the default is the family gets to call the shots, and the clinicians have to do it even if they think it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. With such a wide range there, is it difficult to determine a best practice? You say a lot of states are kind of fuzzy or kind of in the middle of one of the two. How do you determine what is a best practice, or does it really have to be depending on where you're?
It's worse than that. When you say, is it hard to determine a best practice, even putting the laws aside, if you went and polled 1,000 ICU clinicians, or critical care intensivists, and you give them different hypothetical situations, you have a patient in a persistent vegetative state with this multi-organ failure, what do you think is the appropriate thing to do? And you take these different hypothetical situations, the variability in how those 1,000 physicians would answer what the appropriate course of action to take is going to be all over the map. And so that's a big problem, because there is no clear and uniform standard of care. So unfortunately, these are very value-laden decisions, and the medical community itself hasn't reached any consensus on what the right thing to do is. So the legal variation only exacerbates what's already a medical variation.
Is there another layer, or to what extent do either insurance companies or a hospital or a doctor's liability provider, do those entities ever enter in to this discussion at any point?
Not yet. As you can imagine, most people that die every year are over the age of 65. What that means is most people that die every year, their primary health insurance is Medicare. And so far, Medicare basically doesn't make these sorts of cost-benefit judgments. Medicare pays for lots of stuff with diminishing marginal utility. Many people question that, but anyway, so far, the payers haven't been a major driver in these situations.
I wanted to, you talked a little bit about those individuals that are in some sort of a terminal illness or just in a situation where their quality of life is so diminished that they just want to in their life on their terms. And I think most people probably remember back in the days of Dr. Kevorkian and the whole issue that was raised with assisted suicide. Regardless of your perspective on or opinion of that, that's still obviously a very real issue and does differ from state to state. Where ethically, as a bioethicist, how do you approach a decision, or how do you look at a decision like that, where it's the patient that's wanting to make that type of a decision on their quality of life?
So, for decades, since the beginning of bioethics in the early 1970s, the principle of autonomy has been king, right? And so most bioethicists ascribe to the principle of self-determination as the dominant principle. These are value-laden decisions. Who is it for society? Who is it for your doctor to determine what's a worthwhile quality of life for you to live? You're the one living your life in your body. And so generally, I think the dominant trend in bioethics is to defer to the patient's own judgment. In Vermont, Washington, Oregon, Montana, and New Mexico, patients have the legal right to hasten their death through active means with a prescription. And I think that that's going to grow. I think some of the states that are considering legalizing that option are going to succeed, and that trend will continue over the next decade or two decades. And I think that's a good thing. I think people, if that's the right that they want to exercise, they should have that right. I absolutely agree that we should have the safeguards to make sure that you understand what your alternatives are, that you understand your prognosis, and so forth, to make sure that it's an informed and a deliberate decision. So we definitely should have the safeguards. But if after satisfying those safeguards, if you still want to proceed with that decision, you should have that right.
As you look at the scope of where these issues are trending right now and kind of gaze into your crystal ball and look at what doctors and patients may be facing in the future with the advancement of technology, what do you see as the next big ethical question? Or is it kind of the same question, we're just going to have different degrees of how to respond to it?
That's a great question. So a lot of these debates about advanced care planning and about physician aid in dying, you referenced Dr. Kevorkian, have been around for decades. What's new and far less explored is decision-making in dementia. So millions, and it's a growing population, tens of millions of Americans are going to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's and other dementias. And that's a progressive disease. And they're going to be in states that they wouldn't want to live in. Okay, so the problem is, right now you're diagnosed early Alzheimer's, and you know you're going to reach a point where you're not going to be able to recognize your family, communicate with your family, go to the bathroom, and so forth. And you want to say, right now, when I get to that point, I don't want to live like that. Well, the problem is most of those patients aren't dependent upon any technology, so an advanced directive is not going to work. If you were dependent on a feeding tube, you could say, I don't want a feeding tube. That's your right in advanced directive. So here's the new frontier. It's called voluntary stopping eating and drinking, VSED, VSED, voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And basically what you're saying is, if I get to a point, and I'll tell you, I'll define it, that I would find my life intolerable, don't feed me, don't give me any water to drink. The result of that is you will dehydrate and you will be dead in 7 to 14 days. Actually, NPR host Diane Reams' husband, famously, she's been talking about this in her show, he's diagnosed with Parkinson's. He couldn't move his arms, couldn't move his legs, and was deteriorating. And he lived in Maryland, didn't have the right to get a lethal dose of barbiturates to consume. So his doctor advised, just stop drinking and you'll dehydrate and you'll be dead. But the challenge is, can you do that in advance? He made a contemporaneous decision because he still had capacity. Can you in advance tell somebody not to give you water in the future? That's legally unsettled, ethically unsettled, especially your future self might it might be very different and might actually accept the water, might even ask for the water. So can you, basically, it's called a Ulysses contract, can you bind your future self and cause the death of your future self, even though your future self doesn't seem to want that?